Does anybody want to talk about any?
Well, I'd like to hear from people how, you know, where does New York Society for Acoustic Ecology, and I'd like, we've existed for, what now, a year and a half?
Mm-hmm.
We have this connection with the American Society for Acoustic Ecology and the World Forum, and, you know, I'd just like to hear from people their thoughts about what acoustic ecology is and the kinds of things that we're doing and we could be doing and we should be doing and kind of what it all means.
Yeah. That's a really good question.
I don't know if anybody is brave enough to.
All right. I think one of the things we've been involved in is the awareness of sound in our environment, no matter which environment we're in, how it impacts us, what we can do with it, or how we can protect ourselves from it, whatever. You know, there are a whole lot of issues that we've identified as. Interesting ways to work with sound and research and play.
When you say, I just want to ask a little bit more about that because you were saying, if I can repeat it again, an awareness of sound in whatever environment that we're in, and I wonder if you can elaborate on. What that means, you know, in the 21st century in New York City.
Sure. In New York City right now, there's always a lot of sound. I had the opportunity twice to be in a blackout. Once I was sitting on my roof, and my neighborhood was the oldest neighborhood to be shut down. So I could actually hear the grid go off. And for the whole next 24 hours, the city had an entirely different sonic quality. Which was, there was a certain kind of psychic anxiety, you know, that had to do with people who are, like, not in their regular habits and not able to depend on the kind of things that they usually depend on. But there was also, a really different kind of energetic state that has to do with not being impacted by the kind of sound waves that are always going on. Lately, I've been thinking that sound, I always did actually think that sound impacts me physically, whereas visual information is a more kind of something I think about in a different way. We know that a lot of people, more than half of our population in this country lives in cities these days, and so that represents a whole lot of layers, you know, of activity, and sound is rarely considered. And then when you go outside of cities and talk to people, they often go, I can't, you know. They have a lot of, like, sense of relief to get away from it. I don't know, does that...
Separating the nature outside of cities,
that made me think of how sometimes people separate the word nature from cities, but we're a part of nature, just living beings. And I think acoustic ecology is the relationship of ourselves to the natural environment or to the environment. And I think just becoming aware of that, listening to what's around you, whether you're in a city or wherever you are, but in an urban environment, I think you have to actually listen closer to realize how we are integral to the environment and how it impacts us, and how we can see that as nature. I don't know if anyone wants to elaborate on that more.
I've been reading a little bit about ecology and sort of how that word, the origins and how the world word has kind of transformed and what it's been, how it's defined. And one of the things that was kind of interesting to me when I was reading about it, you know, there's all these sort of movements in media ecology, for example, and the definitions relate to kind of systems thinking and thinking about how different energies or strands of elements interact and support each other or not, or so I think that's kind of an interesting thing for us to think about in terms of acoustic ecology in relationship to the city, all these different. I mean, Andrew Callard was talking about the energy, the way our energy, when we lost power, our entire soundscape was completely transformed, you know?
Yeah, it's like the white noise goes off, and that's different. Or when you move to New York and you are not used to, garbage trucks at 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And I remember it took me 2 months to get used to that. Like, that's just a physical kind of thing. And then I also remember when the Crows moved downtown on Sunday. Somehow they figured out that they could, come from Central Park to downtown on Sunday only. Mm-hmm. So that's a kind of funny, I don't know. For me, it was a funny perception.
So the New York soundscape is kind of like this evolving, changing ecosystem.
Giving that mic. And it's interesting what you said about we live in a city, but so we forget that we also live in nature. But we live in an ecosystem before anything. So whether it's an urban ecosystem or upstate New York ecosystem, is still an ecosystem of some sort with different living organisms interacting with one another and with their physical environment. And so I think sound and this thing we're talking about of acoustic ecology is kind of just one layer of, like, one slice of that any particular ecosystem in any given moment. So we just, like, take a little cross-section and we look at it and experience it and think about it in terms of sound. And there's so much information in there. And that's quite inspiring to me, even in an urban environment. And once you take out that layer and you put it in the microscope and you start to really pay attention to it, it points to all these other things in our culture, and like then it gets into the media ecology or cultural geography or like all these other, or economics or history, like it then opens up access to all these other fields. But it's like we have to start by kind of focusing on this one particular sense, which is sound, and then we can draw us in all these other things. But I think the conversation ultimately has to come back to like sound in relationship to, when we're talking about acoustic ecology, like it can't just be sound. It has to be in relationship to something, because it, like, we don't ultimately exist only as sounding beings. Like, somebody hears the sound, somebody makes the sound, the tree in the forest.
So is that, Michelle, is that a process that you use in your own work, this what you said about sort of taking this cross section or this slice?
No, I just got that metaphor right now. It just occurred to me.
So how do you approach the soundscape in your work, or the sound environment or ecosystem?
It depends on what work I'm doing. I mean, in my work as a trying to be some sort of awareness raiser, I probably approach it in a very, that would be a useful technique, actually. Like, let's just focus on sound for a minute and see. But, I mean, in my creative work, it sort of depends what I'm doing, but I think there's an underlying interest in kind of getting others to experience something that I make to have some awareness of sound. So,
hey, Michelle.
Yeah?
Can you tell us what a sound walk is?
Come on. You know what it sounds like.
But I think it's good information to have.
Okay. Well, for those of you at home...
Don't put us at home. Or do put us at home.
For those of you tuning in at home...
You're going to become
part
of our in-group.
The next 10 minutes, I want you to go. Well, I think a sound walk is any journey through any place and time where you have your attention on listening. So... you walk from your apartment to the grocery store, and what you do is listen, and you think about listening, and you act and do listening, and you hear, and you take in the sound, and you have an experience of really hearing. That's the sound walk. I mean, it's nice to do a sound walk with a lot of other people where there's a whole group of people and there's an intentionality behind it and it's focused and there's like this group experience that happens. It's almost like a performance. Then it can be really extra special. But I don't know. That's my experience of a sound walk.
I was thinking about the hearing is the one sense you can't turn off. And when you go to sleep at night, you close your eyes. You see things in your mind's eye, but they don't exist. Or they might exist, but they're not in front of you. But hearing is something that you can't turn off. And I think in some sense, living in a loud city, it becomes something that you wish you didn't have to do. And so for me, acoustic ecology is about listening for listening's sake and not shutting out what I don't want to hear.
Acoustic ecology is listening for listening's sake and not shutting out what you don't want to hear. That's great. That's good.
Yes.
Well, I was just going to say, in related to the sound walk discussion that Michelle was, the description that Michelle was saying, that it bears stating that it's worth stating that the sound walk is really one of the basic practices of the acoustic ecology movement since. I guess it started in the 70s. Were people doing sound walks in the 70s?
Well,
Hildegard Westerkamp created them at that time.
She was doing them kind of on her own. I think it became a more formalized practice that people did with each other a little bit later.
I'm not quite sure when, but I feel like sometime in the 80s that became something that people were actually doing and writing about and talking about. But I think, she was doing walks where she would go out and walk and listen. Yeah.
So let me ask Ned, do you think it's important to not shut out the sounds that you don't want to hear?
Well, I guess the ecology part is sort of admitting that it is a constantly changing living ecosystem. And the sonic part of that is that human beings make sound, and we've managed to make machines that make sound when we don't make sound. And so at some point, pre-industrial revolution, we moved from making sounds that sort of, just by our lack of machines, we were making sounds that emulated natural sounds. That chopping wood kind of sounds like a big woodpecker. But when we invented huge engines and turbines and things that made sound constantly, things that made sound when we weren't doing anything, our sonic environment changed completely to one where there's an element of living in the 21st century with sound, which is, it's almost, it can be incredibly cacophonous. And we know that we could never make that much sound if we tried without these things that we've made. So in a way, it's kind of, I don't know, it's just acknowledging that we've done this and we've created this sonic landscape that's at times unnavigable, really, but that just sort of admitting that that's what we've done.
But Andrea Keller was saying earlier about how sound really affects her physically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you think there are any kind of dangers in not shutting out the sound, or?
Well, I think you can't constantly listen to it. I mean, I know from living in the city, I've had various times when there were sounds that were constant that were invading my home that drove me crazy, pretty much. I would repeatedly call, the police, and they would say, okay, we'll send a squad car around, but I was really panicking because I couldn't think. And I also know that once you start panicking, that changes the way you hear, too. So that sound became the only thing I could hear. And it's interesting because there's a whole biofeedback element to sound that we don't normally necessarily think about, which is once the sound enters our ears, what does it do to our brain and in our bodies? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really, you can make someone physically ill with a sound. And I think that a lot of times, I mean, this is sort of the dark side of acoustic ecology.
Well, actually, the healing people that do body work and polarity work talk about how our bodies have a sonic core,
right,
and a fluid and an energy that expands and contracts like every 6 minutes. And
yeah, we all resonate.
Right, right, yeah. And I think it changes like over our lifetimes also. I also think there are people who can block it out. I used to have a brother-in-law who could sit in a chair and read a really difficult text while his three sons ran around him screaming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I could never do that.
But what was his retention?
I'm sure it was just fine.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think people definitely have blocked it out.
Different people are different. The other thing is I noticed, like, from being in the schools, there's a practice called the silent lunch. And in some elementary schools, all the elementary schools in New York City that I've ever seen, which is a lot of them, have very shiny brick surfaces, very high ceilings, shiny floors, and the sound, that a large sound is generated by, say, 300 children in the same room eating lunch, and it's their only unstructured time of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So they make this huge, you know, cacophony, and I mean, it just like bounces like insanely around on the walls while they're actually nourishing themselves with food. So in order to kind of counteract the wildness of that, some schools have them have lunch with, like, where they're not allowed to make any sound at all. And that's
kind of like, monastic lunch.
That's like, right, a monastic lunch.
So that's putting, like, sound absorption panels on the wall.
Exactly, exactly. So there's two extremes, but nothing in the middle, you know. And you know, so... So I hope someone will fix that soon.
Just picking up a little bit on what Michelle was saying, and Ned. Michelle was kind of surprised how you put acoustic ecology in a much in a social environment. Who's listening? What's it say about them? Because I felt myself a little bit more akin to what Ned was saying, that if, as a musician, the thing that connects me with acoustic ecology, whether I'm right or not, I don't know, is listening. And that's the bit I really connect with. To probably reiterate what Ned was saying, our ears, I guess we can't turn taste off, but our ears we really can't turn off, and we're so known for being visual. And I just think I think one thing that also connects us is to promote the awareness of how good our hearing is and how underrated it is. And that's also part of acoustic ecology, I think, also, that... when we say awareness, it's a slightly underdog position that people don't seem to realise how important hearing is and how good the ears are. We think so visual, everything about human beings is visual, visual, visual. We just don't seem to realise how good our hearing is. I think partly in social life, we're in a culture that really values talking so much more than listening anyway, and that's also part of, for me, acoustic ecology and awareness of listening. I guess that enough for me for a while.
It's funny because speaking of listening, I went in the other room and I heard my voice, so mm-hmm. I'm going to try to talk lower now because I don't like how my radio voice sounds. But this is Michelle. So.
Critical feedback.
It's so lost my train of thought, but you. David, this is something that came up in the class I visited, Andrea, where, and what you just alluded to also, this idea of, like, really not tuning things out, and Armory Shaverick talks a lot about this, too, like, you know, actually really paying attention to noise so that you can be aware of it, so that you can do something about it, or so that you can notice its impact on you, rather than just, like, blocking it out, because everybody can filter out noise. We all do at a certain level. There are certain things that we've come to grow, you know, we've grown used to, regardless of whether we like them or not. And so one of the ideas is to really go back and listen to those sounds again, annoying as they may be or wonderful as they may be, so that we can be aware of them and either actually eliminate them or cherish them or whatever, but be more aware.
I mean, that also touches on deep listening, which is Pauline Oliveris's work that I'm very interested in. And, you know, this idea of, like, listening to everything, listening inclusively, listening to the whole sonosphere, and, you know, not kind of closing off certain aspects of your hearing, but really taking it all in and then finding how it filters through.
That's true, because, I mean, as a composer, I've taught myself to analyze sound. And the one thing that I love about this practice is turning that part of my brain off, literally admitting that there's an entire soundscape that I can't control. I can't edit it. What I can do is take note of it, maybe think about the ramifications of it, but I literally can't change it. I can add to it, but I can't take away from it unless I soundproof everything. I don't know. It's an interesting thing to think about as a composer, to sort of give up control.
Do you find it inspiring to your work?
Yeah, it's totally influenced my work. I've started to incorporate soundscapes into my work a lot more. I mean, I always did ambient music, but it was ambient music by way of electronics. Now I've incorporated sounds, like literally going outside my studio and recording things and bringing them back in has become a much larger part of my practice. So.
That's an interesting part, and that's okay, such a good question, of how much acoustic ecology is related to technology and recording, and how much it isn't, is something I'm curious about.
Well, I see that technology as sort of a means to an end. Mm-hmm. In this practice, you know, it's a way to...
Disagree.
Okay.
Not me, but some people would.
Well, I guess microphones are sort of metaphoric ears.
Mm-hmm.
And recorders are metaphoric brains.
Mm-hmm.
So I see it as sort of that technology is an extension of our own bodies.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to acoustic ecology, we're listening and recording outside of our bodies in order to sort of disseminate what we're hearing.
I mean, a couple things come to mind about that. One of our practices is a sound walk, of course, but then another practice within the field of acoustic ecology is creating historical recordings. So the recording technology is sort of a way to archive our sound environment. But the other thing that I thought about was Chris De Laurenti, who we interviewed in one of the last shows, who does a lot of recordings of... he was at the RNC protest and the WTO protest in Seattle, and he his recordings are really interesting, though, and the way he thinks about them are really interesting to me, and it ties in with, I think, some of the things that you were saying, Ned, about they're an extension of the body, because he really intentionally lets you hear that this is a person recording. You know, you really feel like, I think Hildegard's work too, you really feel like you're a part of that person, or that somehow that person's experience of the sound becomes a part of the recording, whether it's the fact that they're really lo-fi microphones that you can just really hear that particular sound of the equipment that they're using, or the way that, yeah, they're rustling and walking around. So, you know, that's kind of an interesting embodied practice, I guess.
There's a pretty nice wind outside.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just howling?
Yeah. It's quiet.
Nice.
Good.
I'm whistling.
The rustle of the birch trees.
Oh, yeah. That's an incredible thing. So, okay, well, what are some of the things that we're doing about these ideas that we have? I mean, we've talked about, like, sort of raising awareness and stuff, and I wonder if I can get people to talk about some of our projects or solo projects. Or
can you talk briefly about Shangir?
Which you're listening to right now, right? Yeah, you're currently listening to Shangir. Kind of what Andrea Pulley was saying about embodying someone else, I think that's kind of the idea I had with Giant Ear. I think our group, we take submissions from anyone who responds to the requests. You can send them in, and we'd like to play your field recordings. And I see it as kind of, I guess,
sound can actually be powerful. I mean, you can take crackling ice and make it sound like a freight train. You can do anything with sound with a little bit of technology. So I just think it gives a voice to people, and it actually helps us understand other people by listening to field recordings, where they might be in the world at a particular time or place. That could get into psychogeography. I know some other people are working on that in the group. He's not here. So the show is, I think, a way almost of understanding each other or just giving a voice to various people who don't normally have one, or there's no other method to do that in the media, to get a sense of place or what it's like to be someone else in a way. Did you have something to say?
When you say crackling ice, and how can, with a little technology, can sound like something else, to me, I know that there has to be a hard division or at all, but to me that's kind of music. And do you see any division between that and acoustic ecology, or they just merge, or...?
No. I mean, that's debatable. I mean, I think it gets kind of personal
too. Is there a
crossover,
or is there do you feel there's some kind of line where one turns into the other?
Well, I think music becomes kind of more. I would say, I guess, are you talking about just sound, like sound, between sound and music? Well, I think, let's see. There's music concrete, which makes you aware of a certain, I guess, sound, a recognizable kind of sound that can be mutated. But I think, going back to acoustic ecology sounds, I would say it's more taking you to a particular environment, an actual physical place. Hopefully you can actually picture something. While I have accepted music concrete, which would be something that's kind of tweaked a little bit, I don't know how else to put it, I think I've only accepted it for Giant Ear Show because it accentuated a physical sound or an actual sound you could picture in another piece. So maybe it would follow it and accentuate it and bring it out.
It makes sense as a crossover. I'm just curious as to how other people see that. Can you move that crossover?
Is the idea that the Giant Ear sounds are all not processed, or can someone submit a composition that's got processed sounds in it?
I accepted plenty of processed material. If I feel like it relates to a particular something in ecology or some kind of physical presencing that makes you think about your relationship to the environment.
I mean, there's a kind of term that gets thrown around, soundscape composition.
Mm-hmm. What was that?
Soundscape composition, which kind of is it's kind of a term, but it's also kind of a nice way to describe this thing of where you take your beginning material, your source material is generally, I have one, it's generally field recordings, actual sounds.
Wrong.
And then they're stretched out, or they're mixed with the process in some way, but they create a composition. I mean, it's interesting because, well, we have Ben in the room who works almost exclusively with field recordings.
So I'm a musician to answer that, because I myself wouldn't. I play with sound, but I wouldn't consider myself a composer of things. Well, I've made things.
Well,
but what's the difference? I mean, what's the difference between soundscape composition and music on track then?
I'm not a real music term, but I sort of consider music concrete as a kind of fixed in time sort of thing, like it had a certain era, and then...
Well, concrete still exists, but concrete was still more about that it was, since it was so 30s, it was just the idea that natural sounds could be used as an instrument more than the idea of the soundscape.
Right.
With Verez, I think it was Verez that put the jet engines on stage. That was considered concrete because it was a natural sound for a man-made sound.
But concrete really grew out of technology. It grew out of magnetic tape and wire recorders becoming good enough that you could actually suitably record a sound and have it be recognizable. Then it became fun to augment it.
Well, can soundscape composition only exist through the technology too?
You can have a listening composition.
Right. Some of David Dunn's stuff from years ago, I think, of listen for this, listen for that, listen for the other thing. It's a series of directions, I guess. So there is no product other than the directions of how to listen. I guess it's kind of almost a Fluxus thing.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't heard from you.
I'm not actually familiar with soundscape composition, so I'm just kind of collecting what Yeah, I have. I've just never heard of that terminology used to describe it. I've only heard of the soundscape, which is maybe tracing back to Brian Eno or ambient or 616.
How do you approach the stuff that you do? I mean, what do you call it, and how do you go about
doing it? The things I do as far as
working with film things, or... And with sounds?
I guess I come to it from many different angles, but it's simply just a way of collecting events or things that I come across. And then sometimes things are represented as they are, just without changing them, and sometimes they're reworked into completely different pieces.
So the former I would call soundscape, and the latter I would call concrete.
More or less, I guess, yeah.
One thing that comes to mind about some of the things that people have been saying, and I don't know, maybe this is going way too off topic or something, but it just kind of made me think about it, because we're talking about creating these sonic environments, and we're talking about the difference between music and the soundscape composition, and Ned mentioned ambient, and I think ambient was mentioned another time too.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if somebody has some thoughts. I mean, I really don't. I wouldn't know what to say about this question, but what's the relationship between ambient music and what we do in soundscape composition? And I wonder, I mean, I'm sort of, at the same time I'm asking this question, I'm sort of also formulating a thesis about why maybe acoustic ecology and soundscapes in becoming more interesting now to people, that there's some sort of connection between ambient music becoming very popular and what we do, in a way. There's an interest that both groups sort of have.
Well, ambient music was about space, right, mm-hmm. and spatialization, and about how those sounds were perceived in closed or open space.
You mean going back to Eno? I mean, that was part of it, but I thought the primary thing was you didn't have to. In fact, you weren't supposed to give it your attention or your focus. That's what I thought made it ambient. Mm-hmm.
That goes back to Satie, the one great mm-hmm. furniture music.
Furniture
and
music.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it's the idea that that music doesn't have to be this incredible thought process, mm-hmm. that it can actually exist as an environment, something you walk through and inhabit, don't necessarily think about all the time, but it's still affecting you. It's just, it's not necessarily grabbing your ears and shaking them.
So you totally, and the spatialization was, I think, a product of not being focused, so to not grab your attention, as opposed to the other way around.
Potentially.
Yeah.
I think things are always spatialized in such a way, or things that, like the wind that's happening.
Mm.
You know, it's coming from, you know, it's only on the side, or...
It seems like there's kind of a tendency it's interesting that we're talking about acoustic ecology and soundscape composition and music, and I think there's a big part, I don't know why this just occurred to me, but there's a big part of acoustic ecology which isn't necessarily about making music or
mm-hmm.
composing mm-hmm. or making sound art, but which is about advocacy, and which is about like pollution and
mm-hmm.
You know, testing on submarine testing in the ocean, and you know, there's a whole other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure why that just occurred to me.
No, it's important.
Sort of like,
I think it's a good clarification, because I don't think sound recording means acoustic ecology.
Yeah,
right? The association is maybe the easiest to get to, but.
But it's interesting that a good number of the people who began the whole acoustic ecology movement came at it from the sound arts.
Mm-hmm.
from music. Mm-hmm. I think there was some background before those people did that. You know, there was John Cage and Bucky Fuller and other people talking about lots of events happening in the universe, you know, and them overlapping and them having sonic qualities, and whether people noticed them or not was a question. You know, they were kind of like pointing that out.
It seems like there's a lot of research that branches off or is part of acoustic ecology in bioacoustics that I read about a lot, and, you know, sort of studying different animal communication modes. And
Are you speaking of the, like sound in the nervous system?
Oh, well, I mean, the things I know more about are you know, studying whale songs and other animal communication, and you know.
It's kind of interesting to think about what we as, I mean, most of the people in this room are, in fact, artists of some sort or musicians, to think about what we can contribute to the other aspects of acoustic ecology as artists. Because I often think about what can the scientists contribute to me, and what can the activists contribute to me? Mm-hmm. They know about acoustics and about ecology and about sound that I can incorporate into my artistic practice. And I always wonder, like, what can we give back to them in terms of listening or awareness or sensitivity to certain aspects of sound that they might not have?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just to feel like I have a point.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, there's public, there's giving a public face to, you know, just, for example, with this radio show, you know, getting, I think the fact that most of us are, all of us are artists, is made us think about doing a radio show and getting this information out and you know, getting our message out to the public. And I think a lot of the people who are scientists, I mean, activists certainly would do that, but the scientists might not be as well trained at getting those messages out or putting the message in a form that more people can understand in a way.
So I think science tends to be a lot of science. I have a lot of science is about speculation. A lot of innovation comes from specialization, but still having a sort of larger sense of the whole, but maybe artists can kind of get scientists to think in broader strokes. I don't know. I certainly think in really broad strokes.
Yeah. I mean, in some of the work that I've done with scientists, you know, a couple of them have said, you know, I've never really thought about sound, how my work might be interpreted into sound. How I might be able to understand what I'm doing better through sound. So that, and then, you know, there's that side of it too.
I think of as a visual analogy, my awareness of acoustic ecology is much like coming from a big city is the clutter and the chaos, the cacophony, and how it has a psychological impact. It sort of disrupts me. And much in the same way, I would walk into a rich person's apartment. I assume they're rich because I see so much space. Mm-hmm. It's not cluttered. I am not cramped. I can take the emptiness in, and for some reason, I appreciate it anew. And it would be the same thing with the sound. I step into a very expensive car, and it shuts out the city noise. And therefore, I'm not saying that it's the absence of sound. I think it's also a certain arrangement and my awareness to it, and a kind of a feng shui.
A lot of sound art is, hopefully, in a conscious way, adding more sound to the world. I'm curious if people know about sound art where they manage to take it away.
There's a piece, I think it's by an artist named Greg Green, who kind of did that conceptually, where the process of reversing the wave.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a sound wave, and then if you could actually use a computer to produce the exact opposite of it, mm-hmm. they'd cancel each other out and you hear silence. So he recorded traffic during rush hour in mm-hmm. Chicago, and then created a CD that you were supposed to put in your car, and that would, you know, theoretically
uh-huh.
get rid of it. But of course, you know, the only way you could do that would be by some super fast computer.
Exactly what's happening in
the yeah.
Yeah. I think some people doing that with iPods that they've re-outfitted to be transmitters that for cars next to you in traffic that would be a trip that might be on the same frequency because there was limited spectrum. You could mm-hmm. zero out their sound. For example, if they had the windows down and were bothering you or something.
Oh, you find their radio frequency and then just broadcast the thing. That's great. I want to do that.
I do that from inside my house.
Uh-huh. The boom car is going by.
I don't have a car. Bicycle.
But I think Chuck brought up an issue that bears a little bit of talking about anyway, is this like sort of political and economic, just the power relationship about sound and in the urban environment and in personal environment, you know, the way somebody like Gray Philistine, who we had talk at Urban Noise, talked about, you know, use noise as a way of protesting, and you know, that's got a long history. And then, you know, of course, this issue of the neighborhoods that are the quietest or probably have the highest property values versus, you know, mm-hmm. others, and private schools are probably have really nice acoustic tiling in their lunchrooms, and
yes, it's constructive, right? The environment's constructive, mm-hmm. and people accept a certain sound levels, and other people don't. I think there are a lot of overlapping and simultaneously occurring, like, events and social systems and power systems that, you know, that construct various intersections quite differently.
So is there a political dimension to what we're doing, or to acoustic ecology? And
sure, definitely.
There's certainly a cultural dimension to it. I'm not going to point to this culture or that culture, but certainly there are different kinds of, like, noise expression in different cultures, and some cultures are, especially publicly, are very quiet, and others are very loud, and you can experience that in different neighborhoods in New York.
And maybe some people protect themselves better than others, you know, in terms of, like, kind of noise being bombarded by, you know, systemic noise and the noise of others, and too.
Because I was plugging your ears and trees.
And I think planning is an aspect of it. That the planners, the better planners, may be able to eliminate more noise.
Is there any environment where the car alarm would be aesthetically pleasing? I can see you putting it in the Grand Canyon and saying, hey, it's different. Think about world in a different way. You can see that, but it's still not pleasing.
There's a bird in my backyard that emulates a car.
Yeah, right. You know, there's an engine pike piece that is a vocalist singing a car alarm.
Oh,
it actually is pleasing, depending on who's vocalist. And
then I want to do it with the whole chorus.
There was a project to PS1.
Nina Ketch-Dorian.
The car starts chirping.
Sing bird songs. Bird songs.
Yeah.
Huh. But they didn't really sound.
Does that answer Chuck's question?
Well, there are some bad voices.
But what about the like sort of emotional shared reality of a group that wants to produce a lot of alarms?
Like, what does that mean?
Well, what I mean, the fact that you own a car, and this is a piece of property that you keep on the public street, and you don't want it to be stolen. You have some fear of some sense of property with your possession, right? Does that give you the right to create something that makes this mass public disturbance?
Half the people who get car alarms don't even think about the fact that they're getting car alarms. It just comes with the car.
And you can't turn it off.
So it's from the company.
The manufacturers can turn them off, but they said it costs too much because they're already being shipped with them.
Right.
they have to reprogram the car.
Mm.
So it's become an issue.
Like that.
Yeah.
So that's where the public and the private space... you know, kind of, there's like a turf battle there. And I think there's some people in this room that just ride their bicycles and some other people that just buy $76 subway passes every month, too. I mean, you know, the city's different, but certainly not.
Yeah, well, we should all be aware of a certain impact that we have on others. You know, a person who might be, you know, have a heavy workload at school and has a hard time because the construction's right next door and sorry, construction's got to go on. Well, I'm sorry, you're killing my studies.
And your hearing.
Your hearing, that should be, there should be a law against that. There should be standards.
They're really tough to enforce, though.
That's part of the acoustic quality too, though, isn't it? To sure. Some open some way to communicate and form a community that's really interested in sound and doesn't just accept whatever's dished out to them.
Yeah.
Vis-a-vis the guy in, what's his name, San Francisco at the moment, who's trying to sue the whatever the San Francisco transport people are, because he's feeling assaulted by them. Well, I mean, I guess his case is more about publicity and awareness raising, but at least it does that.
Wow, I was just in San Francisco. Your public system is extremely quiet.
I know.
I was like, most of the cars are
compared to New York City.
Yeah. It might be the BART, though. That's different than the Muni.
But it's different in Washington, D.C., too.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it can be quiet, but in New York City, for whatever reasons, people have made other choices and decisions, and they're not. And we just apparently have to accept it. And I guess... somewhere down the road, we're hoping that we don't have to accept that.
Back to the soundscape.
Yep.
Soundscape, did you ever read
What it? Was it? Soundscape?
It was soundscape,
or ambient,
composition.
Or
composition. Composition. I brought three poems by Nan Becker. That's a different kind of soundscape composition because she's speaking of things happening in nature, and she's relying on the ability of our brains to reconstruct the sound, you know, in our own heads. And I thought that was like kind of a funny jump from, you know, what you all were speaking about over there.
Should
Bannon.
I read
them?
Yeah.
Yes. I will.
Okay.
Are we ready to do this?
I think it's beautiful.
Okay.